May it please the court, my name is Charles Hayden and I represent Jermica Shundall Teller, who was convicted of six felony counts, but including the count at issue here, attempted identity theft.
Do you care to reserve some time for rebuttal, sir?
Yes, thank you. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
In this case, Ms. Taylor evidently stole a check belonging to Sandra Clements and walked into a bank with Ms. Clements' check, had apparently forged a check, and then a check made out in the amount of $375. She correctly identifies herself as, "I'm Jermica Taylor, and I have this check, please pay me." And they've refused to hand over that money.
She's listed as the payee, but she had was convicted for forging the actual check holder's signature on that checklist.
That's correct.
And isn't that using the identity of another?
Not to misrepresent her own identity. Implicit in this statute of identity theft is misrepresenting one's own identity.
Didn't she do that when she presented this check as if, as knowing that it was someone else's? She'd put someone else's signature on it?
She certainly committed offenses. She committed the offense of forgery. She committed the offense of uttering. She committed the offense of attempting to obtain money by false pretenses. But she did not commit the offense of attempted identity theft.
Just looking at the statute, though, she used a false name when she signed the check. Is that correct? The signature line on the check
there
was not her name.
There was a on the signature, but she did not.
Okay. But she signed somebody else's name, and the statute says it's a crime to use identifying information of another person to obtain money. And identifying information includes name.
I'm sorry, but I think that as this court noted in the case of Salazar versus Commonwealth, case interpreting the meaning of the identity theft statute at 66 Virginia App 569, it noted, to ascertain the elements that the Commonwealth must prove to support a conviction under the identity theft statute, 182.186.3, we turn to the statute itself. When construing a statute, our primary objective is to ascertain and give effect to legislative intent. The legislative intent, when they passed this law in 2000, was to prevent persons from passing themselves off, misidentifying themselves using identifying information of others. If she had walked in and said, "I'm Sandra Clements, and I'm writing a check myself," she's committed identity theft. She's misrepresenting her own identity. But the position of the Commonwealth seems to be that every time, every single check that is forged also commits the act of identity theft. Was that the intent of the legislature when they passed this statute in 2000? I don't think so. It is certainly just in the term identity theft. That suggests that there's the identity of a person is being stolen to misrepresent, pass off oneself as someone else, and here to say, well, just any use of information incorrectly. Using somebody else's check that has the other person's bank account is misrepresenting oneself.
But Ms. Taylor was the active person. She was on both sides of the transaction. She was acting as the payor and as the payee. And she accurately represented herself as the payee, but not as the payor.
Right, but that goes to the essence of what identity theft is about, is misrepresenting oneself. That's implicit in this statute. It's not enough to the AG in his brief indicated that the court should use the term use broadly. I'm sorry, but that simply doesn't comport with the standards of this court, which for interpretation of statutes. This identity theft statute is a penal statute, and as such, must be strictly construed against the state and limited in application to cases falling clearly within the language of the statute. It's a fundamental statutory rule of construction that penal statutes to be strictly construed against the Commonwealth and in favor of a citizen's liberties. Such statutes may not be extended by implication, but they must be applied to cases clearly described by the language, and the accused is entitled to the benefit of the doubt in the interpreting about any reasonable doubt about the construction of the penal statute. And we have to presume that the General Assembly acted with full knowledge of the strict interpretation that must be implied upon the statute. So when the AG urges us to, let's forget about the strict interpretation, use a liberal interpretation to encompass things not really originally contemplated by the legislature to rope in all kinds of additional offenses, that's not adhering to the traditional rules of statutory interpretation here. Clearly, they're advocating something that would be a novel use of the statute, a novel way of interpreting the statute. One would think if they were correct in their interpretation of the statute that somewhere since this law has been enacted in 2000, the Virginia Supreme Court or this court would have issued a published case that would say, well, every case, every time somebody writes a forges a check, he also commits the offense of identity. But I've looked at every single case. There's only a total of seven published cases. Not one of them say any such thing or remotely suggest it.
Maybe that's because Hampton is the only jurisdiction that would indict for the 18.2 et sec in a forgery case.
Right. And I think clearly there is an implicit, there's a common sense interpretation of what identity theft means, the AG's interpretation doesn't comport with the common sense interpretation. It doesn't comport with the intent of the legislature. Were they really trying to rope in into the identity theft statute offenses that that weren't contemplated? I simply submit that it could not have been the case. And so,
can I ask you on just a technical matter? There was no motion to strike in this case, was there? Everything, if preserved in the closing argument of counsel?
I believe there was a motion to strike. When I write up the statement of the case, I noted that Taylor's counsel made a motion to strike the evidence, not only at the conclusion of the Commonwealth's case in chief, but also at the conclusion of all the evidence. I cite those places. And I normally wouldn't do that unless I thought I had a motion to strike.
I'm scrolling quickly, so I stand corrected.
Normally, if I don't actually see a motion to strike, if there's argument made, I'll say made an argument that was the functional equivalent of a motion to strike. But the fact I said motion to strike here, I think I actually did at some point say move to strike, and certainly there was argument challenging that this identity theft.
I'm sorry, there was a motion to strike. I stand corrected. It was.
If there are no other questions, I'll just reserve the balance of my time.
Very well, thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Jeffrey.
Good morning. May it please the court, Donald Jeffrey, on behalf of the Commonwealth. I think you found it, Judge Petty, but I believe it starts at page 124 of the joint appendix.
I scrolled too quickly. I apologize.
And
Mr. Jeffrey, did the General Assembly really intend that any time that there's a forgery, that automatically there's a conviction for identity theft as well?
I think that may be the net effect of it. And again, it's you don't get in, as the court knows, you don't get into statutory construction if the plain meaning is clear. Use. It's not defined, so we use the normal definition of that word.
Not necessarily a broad definition, but the normal.
The normal one. Right. Use, which would mean, I didn't pull up a dictionary, but to employ would be one way I think you could describe it. And she, I think, without question here, made use of the victim's name and also made use of the account number. There's, if you look at page 142, I think is where the check is. Like most checks, there's an account number at the bottom of this. And you know, the victim certainly identified this as being from her account. So that was the theory that was advanced below. You know, Judge Petty alluded to something. There are some things that are a matter of prosecutorial discretion. I don't.
If this were an NFL game, somebody would have been penalized 15 yards for piling on this one.
Yeah, no question about that, Judge Petty. I defended check cases before we had fancy identity theft statutes, and I even back in those days, I thought the three that you could get was probably a bit of piling on, although maybe I had a bias in the other direction at that point. But
I mean, the net result of all is she whatever we do, she's going to stand convicted of four or five felonies, and
correct.
she got no active sentence to serve for this conviction.
This was a wholly suspended sentence, 3 years suspended, and you know, again, plain meaning, I certainly would take issue with this notion about somehow I'm trying to argue against strict construction. I am, in fact, arguing plain meaning. I think when you look at the case about the use of a firearm, I think to sort of turn Mr. Hayden's argument on its head for just a minute, I don't think the General Assembly necessarily contemplated that someone would be convicted for pistol whipping somebody with a gun during the course of a robbery, but that's the plain meaning of use in that statute. It fits, and certainly if you're going to take this sort of common sense, strict construction approach that he's urging on you, and I would certainly suggest to you there probably isn't some rational reason why the General Assembly would treat pistol whipping any differently from how it would treat if you came in with a tire iron and did the exact same thing. But clearly the court said that fits within our use of a firearm statute. It's not defined. Perhaps I should have given you a dictionary definition that was a little fancier than the one I came up with on my feet here today, but I think I'm pretty close. The only other thing that I would point out to you, and I certainly point this out when we have expansive statutes, I certainly did this on brief, identity theft is a huge evil, and this is a very broadly written statute designed to encompass many, many situations, including those that Mr. Hayden described that aren't necessarily our facts. And obviously the General Assembly thought that this was a big evil. In fact, I think the subsection, if I'm remembering correctly, I think that's a subsection we in the Attorney General's office actually convinced the General Assembly to amend after we had to confess error in a case, because I think we had somebody who had gotten a student loan by using false information. And I think at the time that subsection said goods and services, and there was absolutely no way we could pigeonhole a student loan under it. So it's evolved, but the point being, this is a very, very broadly written statute, and the facts do fit. Any sort of qualms with it, as Judge Petty alluded to, I think are really more issues of prosecutorial discretion and not reversible error. I'm not familiar with the Salazar case. Neither party cited it. You know, I would suggest to you that the one, Georgiou, I guess is how you pronounce it, that, of course, was a venue case, and it dealt with a different subsection, so it's not really germane to your decision in this case. I did note on brief that if you affirm, it does appear that we have a clerical error here. I think it's fairly clear from the record, and I gave you these cites in the record as to how I came up with that. And the facts of this case, she did not get money. I don't believe you had a completed identity theft here, and that's what's described in the order as a completed identity theft. I think it would be an attempted identity theft. Is what the conviction was intended to be for, and the written order does not reflect that. Unless the court has additional questions, I'll rely on my brief. As I said, I think it's a very succinct, plain meaning case, and I'll rely on my brief unless the court has additional questions.
Hearing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Hayden, and I am curious, do you agree that if this is affirmed, that we still have a clerical error, that this should have been an attempted identity theft?
Yes, Your Honor. It was attempted identity theft.
Okay.
That's the indictment for
that's,
sure.
That's what the indictment said.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I would simply I believe that interpreting this statute, that it is implicit that the intention of the legislature is to make it unlawful for a person to use the to obtain goods or services through the use of identifying information of a of another person to misidentify oneself. And that's implicit, I would submit, in this statute. That's the commonly understood notion of identity theft.
Don't you agree with Mr. Jeffers that if, before we get to intent of the legislature, we look at the plain meaning, plain language of the statute? Even if the General Assembly had a totally different intent when they passed it, if the plain language of the statute says something, that's what controls.
If there is no ambiguity, but I submit that there is ambiguity about how the identifying, to just say that there's a misrepresentation made, but no misrepresentation of oneself, it's not identity theft. And I cited the notions of the statutory interpretation principles that the defendant is entitled to any reasonable doubt about the construction of a penal statute, and I certainly submit that it's a reasonable doubt here that did the Commonwealth really mean to rope in all kinds of things not normally incorporated within the notion of the commonly understood meaning of identity theft? I don't think that's what they were intending to do. Our obligation is first and foremost to apply the intent of the legislature, and their intent was to prohibit misidentifying oneself using the identifying information of others, not just simply making use of other person's information. That alone is not enough. It's to misidentify oneself with the other person's information. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll step down and greet counsel and then take up the case of McInnes versus the Commonwealth.